And good evening. You're tuning into Word of Mouth News. My name is Susie Alvarez, and this is CKLN 88.1 FM broadcasting out of Ryerson University.
And my name is Kristen Schwartz. So this is your Word of Mouth News for Friday, July the 23rd, 2010. It is 6:03 in the p.m. On tonight's show, we're going to be hearing from Montreal organizer and journalist and musician Stefan Christoph as he reflects on the G20 a month later and the confronting the impacts of economic austerity. We'll be following up on that topic later in the hour as well, as Don Whites and others will be commenting on this past week's demonstrations against, well, a particular demonstration against the Ontario Liberal Party and government and their cuts to the special diet. And various people will be talking about that between 6:30 and 7. So that's the show coming up for the next hour. We hope you will stay tuned. But first, these are the headlines, thanks to Susie Alvarez.
And Democracy Now! And Al Jazeera. And we begin with environmental news. Efforts by BP to permanently plug the rupture well in the Gulf of Mexico have been suspended due to Tropical Storm Bonnie. According to estimates, if the storm continues on its path, it could slam into the area of the BP oil spill this weekend and possibly bring more oil to shore. Many of the vessels near the site have already been moved as a safety precaution.
And in related news, The Nation magazine has revealed new details about how BP, about how BP is receiving tax credits by relying on cheap or free prison labor to help clean up the Gulf spill. BP's reliance on prison labor has been criticized by many in the region since the disaster has left so many people out of work. But the hiring of prison labor has apparently been financially beneficial for the oil giant. Each new prisoner hired by BP comes with a tax credit of $2,400. On top of that, BP may earn back up to 40% of the wages they pay to prisoners. Prison workers are required to work up to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and are liable to lose earned good time if they refuse the job. Inmates are also forbidden to talk to the public or media. It is unclear how many prisoners are working on the cleanup, in part because they now wear unidentifiable clothing. In the days after the spill, prison workers were seen wearing scarlet pants and white T-shirts with the words inmate labor printed in large red block letters.
And in war and defense news, the Obama administration has lifted a 12-year-old ban on the training of the notorious Indonesian military unit known as Kopassos. This move has been condemned by human rights groups who see Kopassos forces as leading human rights violators during the most recent 50 years in Indonesian history, which include Suharto's seizure of power in 1965, the invasion and occupation of East Timor, and the ongoing conflict in West Papua. Critics of this move also went on to say resumed U.S. training of Kopassos will violate the Leahy Law, which prohibits military assistance to units with unresolved human rights violations.
In news from Iraq, three guards at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad died Thursday in a rocket attack in the Green Zone. All three worked for the private security company Triple Canopy. Two of the guards killed were from Uganda, and one was from Peru. The Washington Post reports the U.S. has long employed Peruvian guards to protect civilian and military installations in Iraq. In recent months, it has begun phasing out Peruvian workers in favor of those coming from Uganda because they work for less money. The Post reports guards from third world countries earn as little as $450 a month. Meanwhile, the State Department is preparing to field its own army in Iraq to protect the massive U.S. embassy in Iraq once combat troops withdraw from the country. The State Department has already requested Black Hawk helicopters, 50 mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, fuel trucks, high-tech surveillance systems, and other military gear, which in a little more than a year will be in the hands of State Department contractors employed in Iraq.
A new report by the U.S. government has accused Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, AIG, JPMorgan Chase and other financial institutions of giving out nearly $1.6 billion in unwarranted bonuses immediately after accepting billions of dollars from the taxpayer-funded bailout. While the report criticizes the excessive bonuses, the government agency issuing the report has no authority to recoup the $1.6 billion. Meanwhile, Wall Street firms are expected to give out another round of large bonuses this year. Goldman Sachs, for example, is on pace to hand out an average of $544,000 per worker in salary and bonuses.
In news from Latin America, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has severed relations with Colombia after Bogota claimed 1,500 Colombian leftist guerrillas were hiding in Venezuelan territory. Chavez called the Colombian accusations a U.S.-inspired aggression. Last year, Chavez suspended bilateral trade with Colombia to protest a deal by Bogota that allowed U.S. forces to use Colombian military bases.
And in Chile, Catholic Church leaders are urging the presidency to pardon military officers jailed for human rights abuses committed during the bloody military rule of General Augusto Pinochet. The proposal will grant a sweeping pardon to aged and long-serving inmates in the country's jails as an act of clemency to mark Chile's celebrations of 200 years of independence. The church's call has angered many of the friends and relatives of those kidnapped and killed under the military rule. Lorena Pizarro, the president of the Relatives of Missing Detainees Association, commented, quote, "The church is turning its back on the victims of the dictatorship. When you speak of mercy, you have to see both sides of the coin," unquote. According to independent estimates, about 35 military personnel jailed for crimes during the so-called Dirty War will apparently be eligible for pardon. Official statistics state that 3,065 opponents of Pinochet's government were killed and 1,200 more disappeared during its 17-year rule. About 600 military personnel have been accused of crimes against humanity, but no more than 150 are now in prison.
Debt relief activists are praising the International Monetary Fund's decision to cancel Haiti's $268 million debt to the institution. But at the same time, groups, including Jubilee USA, have criticized the IMF for continuing to give Haiti loans instead of outright grants. Earlier this week, the IMF gave Haiti a $60 million loan to help fund post-earthquake reconstruction efforts. Eric Lecomte of Jubilee USA said, "The role of the IMF in Haiti has long been criticized, and this new loan could set Haiti on the wrong path toward a new cycle of debt."
And in China, the worst flooding seen in a decade has put growing pressure on the country's network of dams and reservoirs, with many, including the landmark Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River, close to capacity. Two typhoons, Konson and Chantu, and weeks of heavy rain have caused widespread flooding across several of China's southern provinces, affecting 110 million people. More than 1,000 people are dead or missing, and more than 8 million people have been forced to leave their homes. Forecasters have warned that more rains are on the way. The death toll is the highest since 1998, when more than 4,000 people died, while damages from the ongoing disaster have been estimated in the tens of billions of dollars.
In Canada, a group of Barriere Lake Algonquins set up a peaceful blockade on the access road leading to their reserve, about 300 kilometers north of Ottawa, during the early hours of this past Thursday. The defensive action was aimed at stopping a government-appointed electoral officer from holding a nomination meeting on the reserve for the government's highly controversial imposed band council election. The electoral officer aims to implement the federal government's plan to abolish Barriere Lake's traditional leadership selection system by holding nominations in the community for a band council imposed through Section 74 of the Indian Act. Barriere Lake is one of the few First Nations in the country who have never been under the Indian Act's electoral system, continuing instead to operate under a customary governance code that they have used since time immemorial.
And that concludes our headlines for tonight. We are going to go to a quick musical break thanks to Makisa and the song La Saga. And we'll be back with Stefan Christoph and reflections on the G20. So stay tuned and keep it locked on 88.1 FM.
vista. Verso se manifiesto contra esto, expreso mi repudio yo. Más intensos son cada día más, se propagan como plaga, por eso bambú y CO2 inician la saga antifascismo. Es que nunca me dará lo mismo, el cinismo deja que tras un nacionalismo se da el derecho de juzgar tu lugar. Dicen que si no es tu tierra no puedes opinar. Que si eres diferente, debes cambiar. Que si no te gusta, debes largar. Por la violencia te van a obligar. Digo que a mí nunca me harán callar. Lo único que no tolero es la intolerancia. ¿Cómo se permite esta audacia? Una congregación de que promueve discriminación, que se suponen de una raza superior. Hoy tienen su partido y hasta una escuela. Estas son secuelas, hijo de Pinochet, dan pena pensar que gente ve como un tiempo mejor. Este periodo oscuro en que reinó el terror.
Es el momento en que el hombre se esconde de la masa fanática para pisotear a otro hombre de otra raza, sea o sexo.
Llega la saga, un cobrador que no da plaza, así que paga. Sirve más una palabra que metralla. Aunque vistas de cordero, sigo viéndote el plumero, pero desde tu país. Me echaste a la planta y ahora vuelve la raíz fortificada. Si no pasa la tormenta, ¿cómo llegará la calma?
Ding dong.
El infierno quiere tu alma, señori. Escupa a Pinochet y a ese puto Fujimori. Con la saga, cobra, paga, por la plaga, dedo en llaga. Ni perdón ni olvido en la saga.
CO2 bambuda
con la saga. Es la saga, cobra, paga, por la plaga, dedo en llaga. Ni perdón ni olvido en la saga.
CO2 bambuda
con la saga.
Asbun, Le Pen, Thatcher, entre otros, autor intelectuales verdaderos.
Monstruos,
verdaderos,
monstruos.
Se esconden tras el poder, donde todos lo ven, donde pueden ejercer presión, represión, mi opinión sobre las cuestiones que debemos unirnos para generar oposición. Tras el emblema, frente lírico, combatiente, salir a la calle y hacernos más fuerte.
A la carga, la saga comenzando la batalla. Oye, puto nazi, a mí no me das la talla. Vaya, soy ese muchacho que se pasa de la raya. Miro y no veo la factura, así que me la suda que esta tierra sea tuya, porque yo le llamo error a la fuerza sin razón. Sufrí por la matanza en campos de concentración, y si eres creyente reza, porque con mi rima yo pongo fin a tu pureza. Facha, con los emigrantes ha llegado.
And you are listening to Word of Mouth News on CKLN 88.1 FM at 6:15 in the p.m. It is the 23rd of July, this 2010. 1 month ago, Toronto was in the midst of a week of resistance to the global elites. The G8 and G20, the group of eight and the group of 20 political leaders of the world's largest economies, were meeting first in Huntsville and then in Toronto to try to build a consensus on the way forward for their countries economically and politically. $1.3 billion was spent on security for those leaders, and 1,300 protesters were arrested in the largest mass arrest in Canadian history. How can we go beyond those numbers and understand what was happening amongst those leaders and what their decisions mean for regular people in Canada and around the world, and what resistance to their dictates might look like? Joining us now is Stefan Christoff, a journalist, community organizer, and musician living in Montreal. He attended the G8 G20 protests in Toronto, and this week his article, G20 A Month Later, Reflections on Confronting Impacts of Economic Austerity, was published at rabble.ca. Welcome, Stefan, to CKLN and to Word of Mouth, and welcome back, as you've been our guest before.
It's really great to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to talk too much about the protests themselves, but, you know, do tell us about your main impressions and of the protests and the response by the police and the politicians and the community itself in Toronto.
Well, the word community is the main thing that remains in my mind, in the sense that the mobilization in Toronto of so many community groups from across the city, especially on the Community Day of Action, the day prior to the major G20 protest on the Friday afternoon, really left a strong impression for me, just in the sense that you felt that people in Toronto, marginalized communities, and also organizations that are participating all the time in local organizing across the city were really mobilizing in opposition to the G20. That really impressed me, just in the sense that we can critique the international functioning of these institutions, the G8 or G20, and their economic agenda globally. But at the end of the day, it's how these processes impact our communities. And seeing that so many community organizations were mobilized and on the streets in opposition to the G20 really left an impression in my mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole week leading up to the big weekend, there were, you know, themed days of resistance focusing on different issues and different topics, right? I think on the 23rd, that is 1 month ago, it was the climate change focus, and there was a pollution tour of Toronto or something like that. So, mm-hmm. yeah, people really tried to draw attention to specific impacts of decisions of the people with the most power in the society. So
it was amazing. I mean, and I'd say it's markedly different from other convergences that I've seen, just in the sense that every time the G20 meets, there's a protest to oppose the summit. And that happened actually in Montreal, where I live. In 2000, there was a protest in opposition to the G20. That was in October 2000 in downtown Montreal. And thousands protested, but just in terms of the depth of mobilization and the sense of that protest on the streets here in Montreal being connected to issues that are facing people every day, I felt that was really different in Toronto, just in the sense that there was a depth of mobilization, you know, talking, as you said, to the corporations, mining companies specifically in Toronto that are wreaking havoc in many parts of the global south, specifically in Latin America. I remember that was focused on during the toxic tour in the lead up to the G20 protests. I just really got an impression of a difference in terms of the rootedness of the mobilization.
It's great to hear that outside observation. Thank you for that. Your article, you've used the term economic austerity in the title of your article. It's a term that is widely used when talking about the policies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in relation to countries of the global south. When you use it in your article, mm-hmm. What does it mean for us in Canada today?
Well, it means really profound changes to our society. In the piece that I wrote for Rabble, I pointed to a number of specific examples. First, I'll just talk about Quebec. We just had a budget that passed in Quebec that's imposed a flat tax on health care. So that means that every citizen living in Quebec by the year 2012 is going to have to pay $200 a year to go to the hospital or to use any government medical service, any publicly funded medical service. So it's really one step in terms of undermining principles of public health care here in Quebec, but of course across Canada. This healthcare tax was really rooted in the idea that was being promoted by the Liberal government here in Quebec of economic austerity, the same terminology that we saw coming out of the G20. So the idea, again, is that you let these billions in corporate tax breaks go, and that, again, happened in the recent budget here in Quebec. In Quebec, it would be to companies like Bombardier and SNC-Lavalin. SNC-Lavalin is a huge engineering giant in Montreal that actually was responsible for the conceptualization and the construction of the fence in downtown Toronto that surrounded the G20 summit, the three-layer, razor-sharp, military-style fence that was conceived of by this engineering giant company here in Montreal called SNC-Lavalin, who just received huge tax breaks in the last Quebec budget, the same budget that saw the imposition of a healthcare tax on all citizens. SNC-Lavalin, I should mention also, is a corporation that is involved in the military-industrial complex, not only in downtown Toronto in terms of creating a fortress on the streets, but also had a huge contract to make bullets for the U.S. Army between 2003 and 2005 as the American military invaded Iraq. So this is a horrific corporation just in terms of their role in militarization globally, but also militarization here in Canada, because they conceived of and constructed the fence in Toronto. So they just received huge tax breaks here in Quebec. At the same time, we saw the government impose a healthcare tax on citizens. Beyond that, the healthcare tax in Quebec will mean that somebody making $15,000 and somebody making $500,000 will pay the same amount because it's a flat tax.
Yeah.
So
we've got that in Ontario too. It's $150, I think. That was a Dalton McGuinty innovation.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's economic austerity here mm-hmm. in Quebec. And in Ontario, you know, the piece I wrote for Rabble really tried to look at the resistance, that economic austerity led by organizations like the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty against the Harris government. All the direct actions that took place from, you know, famous days like June 15th, 2000 to a whole years and years of campaigning, because all those policies in Ontario were rooted in economic austerity. And we're seeing it nationally now in Canada. But the G20 Toronto Summit Declaration is all about this concept of economic austerity. I just mentioned that the term social justice is not mentioned once in the document. The term environmental justice is not mentioned once in the document. And this is the final text that came out of the G20 summit. It shouldn't be surprising, and it isn't, unfortunately, to me. But I think it speaks to the inherent inhumanity of the economic agenda that's being pushed forward by the G20 that will only enforce poverty here in our own communities, but also internationally.
Now, your article traces a bit of the history of Jim Flaherty, who was the Minister of Finance for the Province of Ontario under Mike Harris and now serves as the Minister of Finance for the Harper Conservative government. And he was also Canada's representative at the G20 meetings.
Yeah.
Tell us about his record and what he was advocating at the G20 sort of fits in.
Well, it's actually really crazy to think that politicians who are responsible for such highly unpopular economic policies in Ontario under Harris, now at the G20, we're given this international platform to push for their policies. So specifically, Flaherty was the one that lobbied. I mean, first I'll just mention the moves to really fight against a very limited tax on major international financial transactions, the Tobin tax or the Robin Hood tax. There was a huge rift within the G20 in the lead-up to the summit in Toronto about the imposition of this tax, and it was most strongly opposed by Jim Flaherty, the Minister of Finance from Canada, and the Canadian government, the Conservative government. They really strongly worked to undermine attempts by European members and also other nations, members to the G20, to try to come to some sort of support for a basic Tobin tax. And this is basically a tax on major international financial transactions that could result in the creation of a pool of financing that could then be used to, say, address global poverty or to make sure that public money isn't spent on bailing out huge international banks in the future. So it's Canada that opposed that tax, and they actually won at the G20 in the sense that the idea of the Robin Hood tax did not come to the table. And beyond that, at the G20, you know, the whole language of Flaherty really pushed for also the idea of balancing budgets. And if we look to Flaherty's agenda here in Canada, balancing budgets means cuts in public spending being the victims of corporate tax cuts. And it's really crazy, but here in Canada, of the G8 or G7 economies in the world, given the conservative government policies, we will, by 2012, have the lowest corporate tax rate in all of the developed world. It will be at a 15% tax rate, which will, by most estimates, reduce government revenues by $14 billion. So we're seeing huge cuts to women's organizations, to Indigenous First Nations organizations, to universities. Like at the University of Toronto right now, we're seeing all the slash and burn happening at the Arts and Science Department at University of Toronto. All these cuts are happening.
Well, not to mention healthcare, public education at the elementary and secondary school levels, and public transit, which is a burning issue here in Toronto for sure. All of this, governments have much less money to, you know, make all these things happen when they're giving the money away to the corporations.
Giving $14 billion.
Yes.
In the case of the Canadian government.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just wanted to highlight that because, you know, the fight around public services is definitely going to heat up in Ontario and nationally. In Ontario, there has been a freeze on public sector wages announced mm-hmm. unilaterally by the premier. And that's going to lead to strikes, you know, in the next mm-hmm. couple of years for sure. You can find out more about that through the Public Service Solidarity Network, through the Labor Council. Stefan, before we go, I want to ask you, what do you think are going to be some of the most active fronts in terms of resistance to these austerity measures in Quebec and in Canada overall?
Well, I think that the fight against the, well, I'll just say Quebec, that's where I am, in Montreal. There's huge opposition to this healthcare tax in Quebec. There's many protests being planned for the fall. Let's hope that those protests do have an impact on the Jean Charest government, the Liberal government here in Quebec. Beyond that, I think that students here in Quebec are gearing up to have another series of huge demonstrations in the next year, over the next school year, because there's also cuts to the secondary education here in the province of Quebec, like we see across the country. And beyond that, in terms of the specific cuts here, we're seeing also a rise in tuition. And Quebec had low tuition, relatively speaking, because of all the struggles of student organizations and all the huge student strikes that happened here. But I mean, I think that the genius, let's say, of the community mobilization around the G20 was really this ability to see that all these policies, you know, in our own communities, you know, cuts to education, to public transit, to healthcare, are really part of a global agenda. It's not something that happens in isolation. It's part of, you know, the G20 process, but it's also part of economic processes internationally. And I think that we can't see these policies happening in isolation, but we can see them internationally. And I think, like, if we look to protest movements throughout the South, I think that there's really clear indications that there's possibilities to undermine the G20 as a process, but more broadly, this type of economic policy. We saw protests across the South and here in North America end the World Trade Organization process. It's still on hold, but I think it's severely damaged its reputation. But that was because of popular resistance. And, you know, if you look at in terms of the agreement on tariffs and trade within the World Trade Organization, a lot of these austerity measures are inherent into that process. Now through the G20, they're trying to be imposed through a different door. But I think, again, we're going to see huge protests, not only here in Canada, but throughout the South, because a protest against increases on the healthcare tax or the creation of a healthcare tax or cuts to education or the defunding of women's organizations because of these huge corporate tax breaks that are being given in Canada is resistance to the G20. So I think, like, the piece I wrote on Rabble just tried to underline and to try to illustrate those connections between the struggles we're facing, and I mean struggles by people not being able to access university or people not being able to access healthcare, and that's increasingly going to become a reality. So it's what we face here in our cities and what is being imposed internationally through the G20.
Well, thank you very much for joining us to talk about these important matters today, Stefan.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
All right. That was Stefan Christoph in Montreal. He's a writer and journalist and community organizer and musician, and joined us here in Toronto for the G20 protests. And that wraps up the first part of Word of Mouth News. Susie's got some music for us.
Yes, we have some music lined up to intro the next half, and we'll be looking at more economic austerity and resistance to economic austerity. So keep it locked on 88.1 FM. This is CKLN.